Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Brighton Rock Podcast, the podcast about the beautiful club within the beautiful game. With me, Russell Guyver, with my co-host Peter Marsh, and with regular contributor Alan Dodd back with us as well. How are you, gentlemen?
Good, thanks. Yeah,
excellent. Hi,
just about got back from Liverpool after an hour-long delay on Saturday evening.
Well, better than that other trip to...
Better. That much shorter than when I actually went to Liverpool. It was like an 8-hour journey back, but still not great. It was free, though, because Avanti Rail are so crap.
What, the Anfield trip, not the...
No, this one. We were an hour and a quarter late on Saturday, so it was we got a full refund.
It's continuous free travel. That sounds like a great
Except you have to spend the time on the actual train, sadly. So.
There is that, yes. Yeah. If it was at the station with a nice craft beer pub nearby, I'm sure you wouldn't be complaining. And you'd be funding your drinking as well then, wouldn't you, with the refund. Brilliant. Anyway, there we go. Well, yes, you've been up to Everton. I wasn't there. Alan, I don't think you were there either, were you, for that one?
No, but I did manage to see most of the game on my iPad. I wonder how. I'm not sure.
But in
all honesty, you probably got a better view than I did.
So the best view is not watching it, I think.
Well, arguably, yeah.
In the interest of clarity,
it wasn't the best game ever.
No, I was going to say, in the interest of clarity, I watched the 25 minutes highlights on Sky, so I've got a vague idea of the details. It'll be interesting to find your thoughts on this. I think I've got my suspicions about a few things Peter wants to discuss. We won't dwell on it for far too long. We will be doing a preview of the Ajax game, for which all three of us will be travelling over midweek. We're speaking here on Monday, and this evening we have Michael Statham coming back on. He came on a couple of years ago. He's a Dutch football expert. I think he's a Villa fan from memory, but he was talking about us signing Veltman back in the day. So it must have been 3 years ago now, I think. And it's going to have him on in part two. So part one is the review of the Everton game. Let's get straight to it. So a 1-1 draw. We started with Verbruggen back in goal. We had Veltman at left back, according to Sky. That isn't driving me nuts at all, the fact they keep doing this. He never, ever plays left back. Why do they keep saying he's playing left back on the graphics? Anyway, yeah, of course, Veltman at right back. And then we had Lewis Dunk back in. And we had, who was it also?
Van Hecker.
Van Hecker, yeah, that's right. Gone blank for a minute. And James Milner, of course, playing in, presumably at left back again.
He was, yeah.
Midfield with Grosch, with Lallana and Gilmore. Yeah. And then up front, we had, of course, Ferguson, who's done well against Everton in the past. And it seemed like the sort of game for him. And we had Adingra and Mittema starting in the wide positions. So that was the team. Peter, let's go to you first. You were there. Overall impressions of the game, first of all?
It was a pretty poor game, to be honest. Everton didn't really have a great deal of ambition. And sat 11 men behind the ball, which, as we all know, is pretty limited, you know, in terms of entertainment, and also not ideal for us. They defended deep, they dug in. We struggled with our final ball. We had a lot of possession, 80% in the end, wasn't it? Which is incredible. But in all honesty, didn't really do that much with it. Didn't really create enough with it. yeah, we didn't break the lines often enough. We didn't get it forward quickly enough. So we kind of just passed it around. To be honest, at times, quite a lot of times, it reminded me of the less good performances under Potter, where we had a lot of the ball but didn't really do much with it. And Ferguson barely got a touch, didn't really get in the game at all because he didn't get any service whatsoever and was taken off. And we looked a bit more lively when Yao Pedro and Fatty especially came on. They gave us a bit more quality up front in the final third. But I think that was more because we were pushing further forward looking for the equaliser than it was any fault of Ferguson's, who just wasn't given the ball and was pretty isolated. Everton defended well, but it must be pretty depressing for them, you know, given their history, to have a manager who plays like that. I mean, it's pretty unambitious, frankly.
Hmm. And we've continued to struggle against Sean Dyche teams. The record continues. Of course, we had a handsome win up at Goodison earlier, last season, but of course that was under previous manager. And then they thrashed us, albeit with a tired and weakened team at the Amex. So the Dyche curse does, to some degree, continue again. At least we didn't lose this time to his side. But then we could have won it if you go on circumstances in the game. Quite need to go through the details. They got an early goal, pretty disappointing. I think it was a second or third bite of the cherry, wasn't it?
It was an element of a foul, I thought, on the halfway line when they won it back a little bit. Went through the back a little bit. Certainly live, I'm not so sure. It probably would have been a bit weak, given it seeing the replay. But certainly live, it looked like someone, what was it, Lallana, or someone went down on the halfway line.
Right.
And when they won it back. And then from there, I mean, they got every bounce of the ball, didn't they, really, from that point? I mean, the cross was deflected. The Bruggen made a really good save, as he did early on from Decore as well, and actually had a really good game, I thought.
Yeah.
And then, if Dunk doesn't deflect it, and this is another frustration. Someone was saying on the London group earlier, there's all this fuss about Young's deflection for our goal, but no one mentions Dunk's deflection for their goal. So it's like both goals were extremely fortunate.
Hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Very annoying. We did get back on terms, or at least we thought we did, for quite a while, fairly soon afterwards, I think only a few minutes later. It was a Pascal Grosch free kick, really well delivered, drifting over a crowded set of players on the edge of the box. And Lewis stepped on and drilled one, an absolute corker of a volley, in off the crossbar for a stunning shot, stunning finish, which was commented on at the time by the commentators as being a fantastic finish, deserving of, saying it's an absolute peach and a deserving equaliser. They carried on talking about it as a done deal, as an equaliser, for a while. And it's only after a while that it transpired a VAR check was taking place. And sure enough, after much deliberation, no line shown on the TV coverage, or at least not the Sky highlights that I saw, which maybe made it a little harder to see. But it looked very, very, very close. I think it might have been onside, personally. That's my opinion looking at it on TV, having seen it in the cold light of day. Either way round, very marginal. They seem to take a while to decide. I'll get your opinions on that from in the ground in a minute. But Alan, I think you wanted to interject first of all on this one.
Yeah, because I know Pete's got a lot to say about this, so I'll leave him to have his say. But I just wanted to say from my perspective, the fact that I was able to watch it live on television, if you like. I mean, from my point of view, when Dunk scored that goal, I mean, I jumped up in the air, made a huge sound, and I thought it was a goal. You know, I had no feeling it was offside whatsoever. The referee didn't think it was an offside. The linesman didn't think it was an offside. The Everton crowd didn't think it was an offside. And the Everton players didn't think it was an offside because they put the ball on the centre circle. So, yeah, as far as I was concerned, 1-1. Fantastic. Superb finish by Dunk. It was a really excellent move. And fine. And then all of a sudden, the commentator said, oh, hang on, VAR. And I was completely shocked. And the angle that they showed on the television, there only seemed to be one particular view they were showing. I couldn't see that Dunk was offside. Certainly not to an extent where it would overrule the referee. It was surreal, to be honest with you. And it took a long time, which is ridiculous.
Yeah,
so that's really what I wanted to say on that. Maybe Peter wants to elaborate on that from his perspective from the crowd. But I certainly felt from where I was sitting that I didn't feel that there was any kind of protestation from the crowd about whether it was offside or anything. I think it was just accepted it was off. It was a good goal. So it was very strange.
Well, Peter, if you want to, and I know you have got plenty to say on this. If you want, first of all, can you start with how long did it take? Because I've only seen the highlights.
It felt like 3.5, 4 minutes, I think, probably, or something like that. I don't remember exactly, but there were 4 minutes of injury time in the first half, and that was pretty much all that happened. Mm. I don't remember anything else really happening, so it was at least 3 minutes. So yeah, I mean, this is where I actually agree when people say VAR should be scrapped, because why are we in the habit of disallowing goals like that for either way? Millimeters from Dunk's arm as well. What they're measuring from seemingly on the replays was Dunk's hand or whatever, which I thought was not, they're not doing anymore after that one where Bamford had it disallowed when he was pointing to where he wanted it. I thought it was from his armpit, but they're clearly not measuring from his armpit on the things I've seen, which also then show that Grosch has already taken the free kick. It's not when he kicked it. It feels to me like Michael Oliver was looking for a reason to disallow it, and it took him 3.5, 4 minutes to find it. It shouldn't be. It should be the other way around. It should be we're looking to find reasons to give goals, especially when they're so good and brilliant, you know, like that. That to me, that's not offside. I don't understand how you can give it.
It's anti-football, isn't it, Peter?
Because yeah.
Exactly what you said was what I was going to say. They seem, and not just with the Albion, with other games as well, they seem to be looking for reasons to cancel things. Surely the essence of football is to have goals, have entertainment, and obviously you rule it out if it's a blatant infringement of the rules or. It was disallowed under one reason or another. But I think with marginal offsides, I mean, we've mentioned already before, I thought we were going to have this auto technology from the World Cup. Don't know what happened with that. Okay, yeah. If they're not having that, fine. If they're not having that, what they should be doing is looking at offside. I don't even think they should have the lines. I think it should be an eye test. So the linesman looks at it. He obviously makes his decision. The referee goes with that or doesn't go with it. Then VAR, if they are still around, can then have a quick look at it and say, right, quick glance without any lines. So you don't have to worry about them failing to get the lines right and wasting even more time, which is what they did with the Burnley-Bournemouth game the other week, which Mike Dean was congratulating them on. Oh, at least we got the right decision. Yeah, but you spent ages getting to the point of being able to start getting the right decision. So
and you got the same decision you would have got on the bloody pitch anyway. Exactly. It's not like they corrected anything.
But avoid the lines altogether and do an eye test. Make sure you've looked up and down to make sure you look for any players wayward on the edge and on the touchline, but on the edge of the pitch. But essentially, look across, and if it's not very clearly offside, don't give it. Go to the daylight. Go to the benefit, the advantage to the attacker for the benefit of the game. Because I think football's about entertainment. Yes, you've got to have rules. But there's no reason why a very marginal call, that's down to the risk of the defender, which it is anyway. And if there is a marginal call, that should be allowed to stand. If they just a quick eye test says, I think that's onside or I'm not sure. If you're not sure, if you can't make a decision quickly enough with VAR, with or without lines, then it's not clear and obvious enough. It's as simple as that. The only exception to that, I know Alan, you wanted to come back in here, but just one final point from me. The only exception to that is, of course, if there are multiple things to look at. So the Newcastle-Arsenal game, there was actually three things they were looking at, whether the ball went out of play, whether it was offside and whether there was a foul. So you can understand it a little bit longer for those things. But when it's a singular thing, the ball's kicked at this point, get the right point. Is Lewis Dunk offside? It's simple as that. And if it's not clear, don't give it. Oh, if it is clear, give it straight away. Don't. Either way around, don't preamble, don't take so long. Alan?
Yeah, I was just really just thinking about something as you were saying, really. And, you know, if you're asked to explain the offside rule to somebody, which I'm not going to try and do now, but I mean, essentially you'll say, well, if the player was actually gaining advantage by being in an advanced position, you know, to me, these marginal decisions, I mean, at the end of the day, Dunk did not gain any kind of advantage from the way he was standing. So to me, it's just a joke. I mean, if you were trying to explain the offside rule to someone who didn't really understand the game, to say, well, if you had your shoulder or your finger pointing slightly out, then that's counted as an advantage. They would just laugh at you.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that I could see was potentially offside is the part of the body which you're not allowed to score with, including the bits that we definitely were not allowed to score with at Tottenham, for example, missing a goal. So I don't see there's an issue. The other thing, of course, the reason offside was introduced in the first place, right back in the day, was to avoid goal hanging. You know, that which is fair enough, because otherwise that completely changes the dynamic of football and you would probably have a pretty dull match, I would imagine, because it would just be big blocks both sides, or what, I don't know what. So I can understand why the rule's there, but the rule isn't the spirit of the game. The reason for the rule is nothing to do with this nitpicking that they're doing over tiny millimeters in games up and down the country. It's driving me mad, Peter.
Yeah, so a little bit of a rant, as you were probably expecting. So I've lost all faith in VAR and referees and in the PGMOL and all of their. So, yeah, that goal disallowed. Yeah, where, you know, clear. Apparently, it was clearly offside from that point. Whereas, for example, the Fulham one last week, different incident, but not a clear and obvious error that he clearly elbowed. Yeah, apparently you can now do that, though, because Bruno elbowed a thingy for Newcastle, didn't he, as well? So now you can basically lead with your elbow, apparently, in a game. That's
by
not
the way,
a problem.
Ref watch, Warnock and Smith. I don't like Smith anyway. I've gone off Warnock now. They both said that was the right decision, just getting it's the wrong decision. He should have been sent off, and the yellow card wasn't acceptable. Well, last week you said that it was all right for Pascal Grosch to be assaulted.
Yeah, well, Warnock did, didn't he? You said Smith agreed with you, didn't he? Or...
Smith
agreed with us last week, yeah. But so basically, I mean, referees on the pitch are inept. So a few examples from the weekend. Decore pulls back Veltman, pulls him back, then kicks the ball away, doesn't get a yellow card.
Mm-hmm.
That's two yellow card offences individually. He got past him, he pulled him back, and then he kicks the ball away. And then later on gets booked for a foul on the edge of the area. So he would have been a second yellow, or he couldn't have made that foul and we might have done something with it. You know, the inconsistency. Three or four times again at the weekend, Everton kicked the ball away. What's happened to the rule about kicking the ball away that the referee at Wolves was so keen to do, where we end up with about six bookings, half of them for kicking the ball away, one of which Enciso passed back to their goalkeeper? What's happened to that rule? Where's it gone? Because apparently...
It's still there. It's still there, Peter, but only if Neil Morpay is warming up on the sidelines.
Yeah, that seems to be the only time I can think of it happening in the last, like, since that Wolves game. We seem to be the only team who've been majorly punished for it. Then, I mean, the additional goal, they should, I mean, to be honest, they should either scrap VAR or go or take it or move to having non-referees do it, because the referees have shown they're inept. They can't handle it. Michael Oliver's supposedly the best in the country, and all he can do is look for reasons to disallow Dunk's goal. And I changed the offside rule as well. It shouldn't be millimetres. It should be a clear advantage, e.g. daylight, like it used to be. Why they changed that? If you're part of you's level, it should be no advantage. So you should actually get away with it. We should be looking to try and encourage teams to score goals. If part of you is level with the player who the defender, then you should be okay and not offside.
By daylight, do you mean so his trailing heel as he's running off towards goal is beyond the furthest back part?
The whole body needs to be past him, which is what it used to be before they changed it and made it more complicated. Because you should be trying to encourage to score goals. That was one of the, as I said, the best goal Lewis Dunk will ever score. And it's chalked off because of petty bureaucrats being arseholes.
Yeah, exactly. And
it's the inconsistency, really. This season it's been worse than ever. And they just seem to get worse each week as well, referees. And some of the stuff that Wolves game, we basically got punished for loads of stuff, which we now doesn't seem to get punished. And there was an example on Saturday when Fatty went through and maybe it wasn't a yellow one and a half or whatever sort of thing, but the guy pulled him back when he's about to go through on goal. It's not a fair reward for basically when a player's about to go through in on the keeper, probably. Anyway, we got a point. Could have been a lot worse and a very fortunate goal.
Yeah, exactly. Alan.
Yeah, no, it's funny. You mentioned that Decore incident with Pascal Gross, because funny enough, I was convinced that when Decore actually got his yellow card, that that was his second yellow, because
it should have been,
because for some reason I subconsciously already assumed that he got a yellow for that previous incident. So I was almost poising my thumbs on my phone to try to put a thing out on WhatsApp saying second yellow, and then I just double checked and realised that actually he didn't get a yellow for that first.
Arguably, that one incident is two yellows on its own.
Exactly.
You literally pull back someone, that's one yellow card, and then you kick the ball away, it's another yellow card.
Yeah.
Interestingly, in the Newcastle-Arsenal game, there was another incident where, I mean, Arteta was losing his rag about the decision over the deciding goal, the only goal of the game. But there was another decision where Longstaff, I think it was, could and probably should have got sent off. And the other way around, was it? I can't remember now.
Havertz, you mean?
Havertz.
It was the other way around, yeah.
The other way around, sorry, yeah.
You could argue that would improve Arsenal, though, if Havertz got sent off.
Probably would have done. So why is Arteta complaining? Because they got away with one there. But what was interesting in that game was three players who complained to the ref were booked simultaneously, one after the other.
Yeah.
Longstaff and I think Gordon and I can't remember who the other one was, but that was interesting that they are applying that rule, because you're not allowed to go to approach the referee fast and aggressively. You're not allowed to contest it in any animated form, and you're not, and more than one of you going to the ref at the same time is deemed as another offence. So any of that is what was basically related to this not surrounding the referee rule that came in at the beginning of the season. Peter.
Again, though, inconsistently. So Gilmore got booked for having a go at the referee when he clearly was fouled in the build-up to one of their chances. Mm. They then spent the afternoon surrounding the referee. I mean, Tarkowski is captain, but he was still in his face all afternoon because he's basically a thug. And they had other players jump up and surround the referee and that sort of thing. Didn't book one of them.
Yeah.
So how is it that Gilmore gets booked and then their players are allowed to surround him three or four when their alleged penalty chances came up, which neither of which were. But... you know, when they, again, as with all big physical teams, they went down very easily.
And quickly on the penalties.
Tarkowski was very prominent on the television coverage, actually.
As always.
Particularly in the second half, he was constantly either being told off by the referee or he was moaning at the referee or there's something going on in the penalty.
I can't stand him. I can't either.
Yeah.
These penalties, briefly on that, before we round up part one, or at least the match side of things, Peter, just on the penalty front, could you describe those, what you saw?
First one was up our end, actually, so I saw it reasonably well, and the guy looked like he went down quite easily, and I think it was outside the area anyway. Veltman kind of collided almost, but I don't really see it as a, it was definitely wasn't a penalty. It might have, you could argue it possibly might have been a free kick, but second one, I think Calvert-Lewin's backing into Van Hecker as much as Van Hecker is doing anything initially. And then because he backs in and fouls him, arguably, then he kind of almost gets away. And yeah, I mean, it's not a penalty. Dyche is looking for reasons to moan when actually the referee was pretty much gave most decisions their way.
Yeah.
Actually, that first one with Veltman, actually, he was actually pushed onto the player. If you actually look at the incident, he was actually pushed by one of the other defenders. I'm not sure who it was. So he was falling over and actually fell onto the other player to knock him over. Yeah.
So, yeah. So we don't think either of them are, I think, a penalty. Yeah. But, yeah, it's, Dyche, as always, moaned about the referee and he's in his gravelly voice and getting, he's an arsehole as well.
I just don't like him.
No, I don't either. And his teams are always effective, but doesn't mean they're nice to watch. And frankly, I'd be embarrassed if I was an Everton fan. I mean, you literally play at home to a team who you regard as historically so much lower than you, so much below you, and you get 20% possession. That's embarrassing to me. I mean, it's like the way they played. Yeah, they created a few chances, but that's mainly because we were pushed up and, you know. But I thought that Verbruggen played well. I thought Van Hecker had a really good game and Dunkey. No one further forward really did enough to get... I mean, people were saying about Mitoma, but to be honest, I thought it was a pretty poor cross for the goal. It wasn't, you know, he did well to beat his man, but actually he hit the first man. And on another day, that would have been blocked out or whatever. But it just happened to freakishly kind of deflect off Young.
Yeah, I think, watching it on the TV, I mean, we were playing some lovely, neat football around, but it wasn't doing anything.
Yeah.
It was actually, normally when you see those kind of games with a high possession, you feel as though occasionally we do actually break the lines and do something, but this time it was got a little bit embarrassing actually, and I felt a little bit embarrassed. So I was talking to some people at work today, and they didn't actually watch the game, but they were kind of alluding to that kind of thing that they've noticed that with Brighton in the past. You know, it's fair enough knocking the ball around, but it's having all that possession.
Yeah, it felt
and I couldn't defend and I couldn't defend it really.
I don't think we intended to be like that, but I think we were just trying to get the kind of chance to break the lines. But Everton, to be fair to them, defended pretty well, but it's not that difficult to defend when you put 11 men behind the ball. You know, it's quite a simple game then. You just, you know, kind of it's quite hard to break through. And I do think, and I think De Zerbi alluded to it, we should have shot more. And I do think we've been discussing on the groups about missing Enciso. And I think that's where we really do miss him, because he's one who can shoot from long range and has done. And then you've always got the chance of a deflection then, or a, you know, kind of, you know, something kind of, like we got for the goal, obviously, but from across, but from a shot as well. And we need someone who's willing to take a shot from long range to kind of cover, but we don't seem to have got people who are willing to do that so much now. And yeah, De Zerbi said after Fulham that we didn't build up quickly enough, and we didn't again here as well. So I don't know what, he can't keep saying that and not, he needs to be taking the blame for whatever we're doing as well. With the number of times we had space, a little bit of space on the wing, but didn't use it, with the Dingra out wide, especially.
Got to take some shots, some early shots, and keep them on target. Not like the some of the ones we've seen with Belaba.
Dunkey did hit the target from a free kick, but there's a lot made of Pickford save then, but actually it was pretty much next to him.
Yeah, and then there was. Yeah, I mean, I'm not keen on the dunk free kick.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know why he keeps, the only free kicks he's ever scored were the ones where the keeper's been in the wrong corner. I don't understand why he keeps taking them. I know he's getting a bit closer, but surely there's someone like Mittimer or Solly when he was fit, or Pascal or someone like that. You know, someone who could take a better free kick than the centre back.
Yeah, you've got to get the keeper to think about where you're actually going to be placing your free kick. I mean, I think just the way that Dunk lines up, I mean, he's going to hit it that direction. I mean, Pickford knew it was going to go that way. I mean,
yeah,
obviously he had to move quite quickly, but
no, exactly. And he didn't have much to do. He was quite near it, and it's just frustrating because we're wasting good opportunities. And yeah, I would have thought Pascal or Carew would have been obvious ones.
Yeah.
And on the subject of the Everton game, the goal we did score, well, the other goal we scored, the one Mittimer's deflection went in. Good ball over from, it was Lallana, wasn't it, I think?
Lallana was off by then.
Oh, yeah, of course, he's gone off, hasn't he? I couldn't see who it was from the highlights. They didn't actually describe who it was.
It was a lovely pass.
Great. It was, yeah. He looked quite bright when he came on. I thought he looked brighter against Fulham as well. I think he may be one who's starting to move forward. Yeah, he's obviously got a good pedigree.
I think he's good. He's a silky player. He's an elegant sort of player, isn't he? Maybe some would say lacking a bit of, it might be a bit lightweight, but I think he's finding his ways, finding his feet.
He needs Belaba alongside him, I think, probably. Him and Gilmore and Grosch probably a bit too alike, and there isn't really the player to get stuck in the middle.
Yeah, his greater fitness is going to improve him, isn't it? I think he's probably toning up. He's probably getting match sharp and all that stuff as well. And you know, I think he's going to be a key player, I think, this season. Obviously, the other good news, by the way, our Dutch football expert who's supposed to join us for part two is running a bit late, so we'll go on to the other subjects we're going to cover. Actually, I was going to say what was I talking about? De Hood,
Modder.
Modder, obviously is another midfielder that we'll be looking to utilise. He's coming back to fitness, thankfully, at long last. There's other players like Enciso and Estupiñán who we're waiting on as well, of course, further down the line. But Modder has started to play a couple of games for the in the youth levels to get some match fitness. Looking good. I think, Alan, did you see the under-19s game on Friday? I caught a bit of it, but not a great deal, to be honest.
Yeah, I watched a little bit. It was actually, I think, I'm not sure if it's still on YouTube, but it was on YouTube, the entire game. So you can watch the full 45 minutes. I did watch some of it, and he was getting stuck in. He wasn't standing back, so he's kind of he's getting involved. I mean, I must
have had some height, won't he? Because he's like 6'3" or whatever in midfield.
He's a big unit compared to the
we need some height in midfield.
But the funny thing was, I mean, I'm feeling like probably what my mother used to feel when she used to watch me playing sports. You know, kind of worrying all the time that I'm going to hurt myself. I'm sitting there, I'm just hoping that he's going to get through the game and nothing's going to happen, hopefully
we'll
get over that, because
there is the age-old adage as well of, are they going to be as good as Sharp? Are they going to be obviously the psychological thing doesn't sound like a problem, but the other issues are they going to be simply as good as they were before? I guess we'll never know at this stage, but hopefully we'll find out.
There is a Twitter rumor that he might be involved on Sunday, but only a Twitter rumor at the moment. So who knows?
Well, that will be interesting. And I mean, it's a bonus to get him back in any shape or form.
Yeah. We can't expect too much from him initially. He won't.
No.
And it's actually an era we've got a few players in as well, unlike the wings, for example, and fullback.
I think we're going to lose Belieber, aren't we? February time for the
Nations Cup.
Yeah, so, that's right. And is there an Asian Cup on as well?
Yeah, there is as well. Yeah. So Mittema's going, Adingra's going to go as well. So our two fit wingers will be going in for the African Nations Cup and Asian Cup.
Hopefully, and Ciso will be back by then. I know.
Yeah. But he's not a winger either. He's better in the centre.
Yeah.
Playing wingers. Go to three at the back and just play wing backs.
Yeah. We know Solly's not going to be back. That's the main problem.
Yeah, and Tarek presumably, if he's fit, will be in the African Nations Cup. I assume Garner will be there.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm assuming so.
But even fewer wide players than we currently have.
Yeah, it's absolutely madness, isn't it? Well, we need to keep fit who we do have.
Evan and maybe Ferguson, bring in one or two signings in January as well.
Yeah, exactly. Evan Ferguson and the rest of them, we've got to wrap them in cotton wool or do something. I don't know what.
Yes, there's been no news about Welbeck, has there, after?
No, it's gone very quiet. No pictures, no nothing.
It was just the press conference, wasn't there, from De Zerbi, which said that both players were going to be out for the long time, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Obviously,
I mean, you assume at least a season, judging by what you've heard, but there's been no mention of Welbeck at all.
No. We haven't even had formal clarification that it's a hamstring, have we? Although we strongly suspect it is. But those can be, as we've seen before with Tarek, wasn't it? Can be long layoffs, depending on what the nature of the injury and whether you get a setback on the way to recovery. It's what happened with him, I think, as well. All that kind of thing.
Tarek was injured in a warm-up the other day, wasn't he, supposedly? Wasn't on the bench in the end.
Yeah, exactly. I think we've also going to have time to talk about the women's game, so we haven't mentioned that for a while, so we'll come on to that in a second. But one other bit from the men's senior game to talk about, one bit of good news is that Jason Steele has signed a new contract. He's the latest one to add his name. I think it's a two-year deal, isn't it? Is it 3 years? So it's taking...
Yeah, 2026. Well, 2.5 sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, which is good. Yeah, split the difference, which is great stuff. I mean, it's an interesting story. He featured on Football Focus this week, and it was really interesting to hear him talking because he was at Sunderland. He was involved in that time where they had the TV programme about him. And they were a total and utter mess. And he was depicted as one of the villains of the piece, you know, not doing well, struggling, being a kind of a northeastern lad as well originally. You know, he seemed to have taken the burden. And he was in a bad place, I think. He was quite pretty down about his football. I think in the interview he mentioned that he was kind of on the verge of thinking about giving it up. And he was, you know, his decision to come to Brighton, he just wanted a change. It was an enticing offer in general, just in terms of, you know, the club and what the project is, as they like to say. But I think a fresh change and it not being about money or about anything particularly lucrative to do with the contract, but more about just being able to get into a good club where he might be able to just reset himself and then slowly build himself back up is what he wanted. Obviously, he came in as a number two. He had to bide his time for quite a while. We won't talk about the whole Sanchez behaviour when he eventually got ousted in place of Steele to come in his place. But it's been a good story, isn't it? He's really battled back from nowhere. I don't think he was ever very highly rated at any one club.
No, he wasn't. The irony is that the player who he and David Button were signed the same summer to compete, ostensibly because they were homegrown keepers, I think, because they wanted to... Yeah. Ryan was pretty much certainly number one at the time. But Button was seen as a better option and bit as number two and played number two and Steele's number three. Button is Cal currently playing for Reading, who are bottom of League One, while Steele is playing for in a seventh place in the Premier League and in the Europa League. Yeah. I mean, you couldn't really make it up, could you? But yeah, I mean, Sunderland, obviously when he was at Sunderland, it was obviously toxic and it's almost like players don't respond well to toxic environments when they're dumped in them. You know, who'd have thought it?
Yeah, but he's settled down. I think he's moved down and he's sort of settled in the area. And of course, he's sharing number one duties with Verbruggen. Basically, they're both number ones, aren't they? In terms of
Hecky. I think we all know Verbruggen will become number one in over the next year or so. He had a really good game at the weekend. He's bigger, he's stronger. He needs to maybe develop exactly the kind of passing game that De Zerbi wants because his distribution is clearly good, but he hasn't quite picked up the kind of distribution yet, but his reflexes have shown at the weekend where he made two really good saves, especially the first one that from before that led to the goal afterwards was a really good save where he could stuck his arm out and pushed it away. And, you know, people will say he pushed it back into the back to the same guy, but there's nothing more he could have done there. You know, he kind of he had no time to kind of push it aside. But yeah, I thought he had a good game the weekend, and it'll give him confidence, hopefully. Conceding a deflected goal, and he handled well. So, barring a rather scrambly corner at the end that was a bit panicky.
Yeah, indeed. Moving on to the women's game then. I mentioned just now we're going to talk about that. Just briefly, our game was covered live on TV. What was it, Sky? It was a home match, so it was at Crawley against Man United. I think there was nearly 3,500 there. The crowds are going up, which is great. That was commented on by the TV guys in their coverage. It's building a good thing. More compliments about the club as a whole. Melissa Phillips is definitely settling into her stride. I think it's going to take time to get her vision across. I think she's trying to find out still at this stage what she's got, you know, how best she can use some of the players. She's still finding her feet a bit, but you can see there's progress going on there. They've started to play well. They got two goals I think they bookended a 4-2 defeat at Chelsea with the goals, the first and last goals, which is not a bad result really against one of the best teams. Incidentally, Emma Hayes apparently is leaving at the end of the season, which is interesting. But anyway, that's the USA job, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
But Melissa is from the USA herself. I think she's in for the long term. I think she's got some strategies. They were analysing it quite nicely, actually. There's a lot of good input from Stephen Warnock on the half time. They were talking about how they were doing a high press and trying to push Man United to one particular side, United's left or right, and forcing the pressure there because they perceived that as being the weaker area for this particular game. And that led to the press led to a goal, which had really well worked, a 3 or 4 pass, quick, slick moving and a convincing finish. And she's adapting tactics within matches, which is obviously a great attribute to have and a great skill and strength to have. And I think over time, she'll be all right. I mean, we're fourth bottom. We've got 4 points. But to be honest with you, while we've struggled in the early weeks to not be on the bottom with some of the results we've had, quite happy with that. And I think we'll go from strength to strength. United are a very good team. They've got several internationals, England internationals there. Ellie Toon scored a brilliant goal in the game. The goalkeeper, of course, who we all know, Mary Earp, is an excellent goalkeeper, and she had a very good game, it has to be said. United did have loads of shots and more shots on target, more possession. But we were unlucky, and we were unlucky because, yes, it transfers to the women's game. Biased refereeing in favour of Manchester United against Brighton. I know there was a debate about a possible penalty at the other end. I'm not convinced that was actually a penalty anyway. But at United's attacking end of the pitch, we had the ball. Player was blatantly fouled. And then the same player who committed that offence then gets free rein to then run in, cross, and there's a goal. And that was back to 1-1. We seem to have snatched it right near the end with a really well-taken set-piece, cross-header into the goal in, I think it was the 84th minute. They then added 7 minutes in stoppage time. And then I think the nearly into the 9th minute of stoppage time, they scored. I do think there was enough added time in the added time. That actually, I don't think she had a criticism actually, Melissa, about whether that was too much added time, but I counted it. It was actually, I think they'd given too much, but United scored within the amount that they should have added in the added time, if that makes sense. So disappointingly, 2-2 in the end, but still a pretty good result against a very kind of well funded and proactive team. Thoughts on that, guys?
Yeah, decent result. Had a couple of disappointing ones against West Ham and Spurs at home, wasn't it? Where we possibly didn't quite click, and yeah, having won at Everton first game. Gave a good account of Chelsea. Lost 4-2 in the end, but we're ahead at half time and looking, or just before half time. And then, yeah, decent draw against United. So hopefully, suggests the top of corner is being turned. And yeah, the one interesting one at the moment, are Villa. They've lost 5 out of 5, including 6-0 to Chelsea the weekend after they had a really good season last year.
Yeah, they were coming in with a really ambitious profile, and you thought, oh, this is going to be interesting to see how they...
And their men's team can't do the same.
Yeah. It's annoying though, isn't it? The Uniteds and Villas have jumped on the bandwagon a bit later and seem to have had a sort of like a privileged progression because of the funding that goes behind them. Obviously, you know, that is what it is, but it's pretty irritating when much more established clubs, I'm not particularly saying Brighton here, but other clubs who've been working on things for longer are kind of potentially getting surpassed. So in a kind of way, I'm quite pleased that Villa are struggling. I just wish we could have beaten United. That would have been good. Because they're in the middle at the moment. And I think we could have taken them. And it's a shame we didn't quite get there. But good crowd, as I said. And that's positive. Alan.
Yeah, no, I was going to say something about the crowd because I heard it was very busy. I'm just wondering whether actually the time of the kickoff might be quite good for the ladies' game because it's kind of, get Sunday lunch out of the way and take the family to the ladies' match a little bit later. But it's not, you know, it's at a time when you can still get home in time for school the following day. I'm not sure whether that has an impact.
Possibly so. Yeah, might be the case. Well, just to round off part one, then one other bit. I'll just bring it back to the men's game and just from the weekend. We'll talk about the FA Cup probably at the tail end of the show. But in terms of the Premier League, Gary O'Neill, is he getting another apology? They seem to get shafted again. This time to rock bottom Sheffield United, who were gifted their first ever win of this season, 2-1 defeat. Sheffield United winning 2-1 at Bramall Lane. It's outrageous, isn't it? Another poor refereeing performance there. In a way, though, I'm quite pleased Sheffield United got the win because I had the nasty feeling that was coming, not necessarily as a two-pack, maybe just in isolation. And if it wasn't going to be that weekend, it was going to be next weekend. So in a weird sort of way, I feel more confident with us getting the job done against United now, Sheffield United. And now they've got that win out of the way. Not that I thought they probably deserved it, to be honest with you. A weird weekend, Luton getting a draw with Liverpool, nearly beating them as well. So some odd results in general. What do you think?
Forest Villa as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I enjoyed that.
How tough. I mean, obviously, our next away game in the league is Forest. So that's a tough one. And in a way, the Liverpool and Forest and different results show, put in the context that actually a point at Everton who have improved quite a lot. And as we know, Dyche is our kryptonite in a lot of ways. Is actually a pretty decent result, as much as, you know, I didn't think we played great, and I actually didn't think we deserved anything more, but I also don't think Everton deserved to win because their tactics were so negative, and I don't think if you at home play 11 men behind the ball for 90 minutes and have 20% possession, you deserve anything from the game. And I don't think in that situation you can complain when it's a deflection as well, because you basically are playing so deep, there's so many men behind the ball that you're leaving yourself open to a deflection because there's so many players he could bounce off. So, and also I don't like Dyche and his tactics anyway.
Who does? And I mean, the stats, 80%, that you mentioned it earlier, 80% possession, I think, is one of the highest in recorded history in the division.
Especially for an away team.
Yeah, I mean, and I think we had something like four times as many passes and completed passes and all that sort of stuff as well. It just shows the dominance in one phase, but obviously, as I said, that nut to crack thing still being a problem in terms of Sean Dyche. Alan?
Yeah, I think I read somewhere that we had 420 passes in the first half, 82% possession. And that number of passes was actually a record since Man City against Watford 2 or 3 years ago, so seasons ago. So, we keep breaking records.
we do tend to do that, don't we? While we're on the subject of stats, actually, one other bit just to bring up. Lewis Dunn coming, I've quoted him a couple of times, his stats from this season already. But I've noticed that the latest ones, he's now gone, especially because of Rodri having that suspension, he's gone well clear now. He already was top of a couple of stats. Most touches after the Everton game, he's now up to 1,253. Next nearest is Kieran Trippier with 1,080. And then Rodri just behind that, followed by Saliba and Silva, Thiago Silva. And then on by most passes, again, Dunk is top with 1,144, which is mad. Rodri, the next nearest, 924, which is at least three games worth behind, interestingly. And then you've got Saliba again, 911, Thiago Silva, 851, and Kieran Trippier, 800. So the same suspects in both categories, which is also interesting. And one other set of stats before I go back to you, Adam, for the last word on that. Most fouls won, Jordan Ayew's been there consistently for, I think, a couple of seasons now, with 37. Then you've got James Maddison, 29, Bruno Guimaraes on 26, Bukayo Saka on 24, and Joel Veltman has emerged into the list, also on 24, following the weekend, which is not something I have to admit that I expected to see amongst the stats, but interesting. Alan?
Yeah, no, I think it's something when you were, when you disappeared from the recording earlier, I was just talking to Peter, and I think I was just talking about you know, the fact that we were passing the ball around a lot, but not really doing a lot with it against Everton. And I think, yeah, when you mentioned the dunk statistic, that kind of, you know, for that particular game, if anybody, an outsider was looking at it and say, well, no wonder he's got so many touches when we're just knocking the ball around at the back so often. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'd say Van Hecker was also up there as well for that reason, because he had a lot, he had a lot of touches. But yeah, he's looking, I really like the, he's, to me, he despite our defensive frailties, he looks one of the finds of the season. He, you know, I really hope he, they get a new longer. Yeah. I'm hoping that the 1 year deal was based on an extension being triggered by X number of appearances, 20 appearances like that, and that he'll soon be kind of having a longer term contract, because he looks a real option, really good option at the back. And to be honest, based on the game against that Fulham and the weekend, I'd say Webster is now fourth choice.
Yeah,
I think I agree with you. I think Webster is running down the pecking order quite a lot.
Yeah, and I think he'll leave in the summer, I imagine.
Yeah, I think Van Hecke actually was kind of, I think he was a little bit reticent about signing a new contract as well, because I think he was. He was getting concerned at the beginning of the season whether he was actually going to get the game time, but actually it's turning out that he's getting the game time. So
yeah, which is why I wonder whether there's a trigger in there at least for another year or two once he plays X number of games, 20 or 30 or something like that. Yeah, because like we wouldn't have wanted to give him only a 1 year and not anything else. So hopefully there's a trigger we can do if he gets 25, 30 games. And yeah, he and Dunk looked the first choice to me, with Igor as backup and Webster sadly probably only being used against maybe teams like Sheffield United or when we've had quite a few games, because he, as much as I like Webster, he does have mistakes in him, and he's had a few this year already.
Yeah, Igor is getting better and better every game.
Yeah, and he Igor obviously only played like five games for us, whereas Webster's played quite a lot.
Yeah,
he looks great, doesn't he? I mean, maybe the is it the Scalotto song? He's massive, you know. You'll never get past Julio. Maybe that works. I don't know.
Well, we've yet to see his really fiery side, though. They got him 11 yellow cards and 2 reds last season. Mm. I'm not sure he's got a booking yet, has he?
No.
Yeah.
Well, I do actually follow him on Instagram, and all his Instagram posts seem to be him in the gym with his shirt off. So. Doing lots of weights, so he's a beast, basically.
From one Brazilian, by the way, to another one, João Pedro called up. called up for Brazil squad today, which means that Albion have current Brazil, Argentinian, German, English internationals, which you wouldn't necessarily, amongst various other nationalities as well, we've got, but those four stand out as four of the biggest ones in the world. And yeah, we've got current, once he hopefully Pedro gets a game for them, we'll have current internationals for all four of those teams, which is incredible, really.
Yeah. And also two long-term, in for the long-term Dutch internationals there.
That's true. Yeah, Dutch ones.
Yeah. Plus, obviously, Veltman has performed in the Dutch team as well.
But Van Hecker, he hasn't been in the first team squad yet for Dutch. He can't be far off if he carries on playing like this for us.
I think he's been in a couple of camps, but not involved.
Yeah,
in
the he must be getting close, because he's been playing really well for us this season, I think, and he looks more confident each game. And I think he'll get, the more games he gets, the better he gets. So I think he'll be in there soon. But Bruggen obviously made his debut in the last set of games, didn't he? So
he did, yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, and these players aren't even that, except Dunkey and Rusquell, but a lot of them are quite young, like Pedro, like Buonanotte, who's been in the Argentinian squad and played for Argentina, and players like that. So it's quite incredible, really. And you imagine like back 10 years, or even 6 or 7 years, the idea we had internationals for all those countries.
Yeah, it was funny because I was thinking
we'd have a Lithuania international or something like that.
We had fans like Australian or whatever when we went up and that sort of thing. But not like, yeah.
hopefully Modder gets back in the Poland squad once he's up and running as well. Yeah. But I think, you know, it's, I was just thinking the other day, I'm talking to someone about João Pedro, but I wonder if he'll get overlooked, whether he'll ever get called up. And lo and behold, I think literally about 3 or 4 days later, the news arrived. So,
you sure that person wasn't the Brazil squad, Brazil coach?
I was talking to the head of the Brazilian FA at the time. Yeah.
hopefully they might improve his second touch at the, on the training pitch.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's the only thing, isn't it? His first touch is a bit questionable sometimes. But,
yeah, I agree with you. But what he does do, things happen when he comes on. He tries things. He doesn't always come off. Yeah. He'll try like little flicks and turns and things that actually in a game like Saturday you need, because I think De Zerbi's plans were pretty clear from Saturday to be on a team. He's targeting Ajax. Not playing either Pedro or Fathi from the start. Otherwise, the same with Belaber. I think he was keeping him back. Arguably one or two others as well. Possibly Lamptey, although obviously he's now injured again. But yeah, I think he was targeting Ajax and he was keeping back arguably our best two attackers recently, or definitely our best two attackers recently for that game, because otherwise it's inexplicable that they neither of Pedro and Fathi started.
Yeah. And in terms of, we mentioned earlier the Dutch players, speaking of the Netherlands, it's part two coming up in a moment where we are going to be previewing that big trip away. It's Alan and my first European trip. Peter, you've already been to Marseille.
I'm a veteran.
You're a veteran by now, and you're going to Athens, which I'm not as well. But anyway, we'll be previewing the big preview of the Ajax game coming up in part two. We will be doing a Europa away trip special. I don't know what we're going to call it exactly. It won't be a match day special. It'll be over the 3 days. But we'll have that coming up as our next episode. But the next part of this episode will be the preview of that match. Okay, so part two, we are now delighted to be joined by Michael Statham, who is a Dutch football expert. He's not Dutch, but he is a Dutch football expert. Welcome to the podcast, Michael. How are you?
Thanks for having me. Yeah, football down here is what we do, Dutch football in English language.
Yeah, and in fact, I should say welcome back, because we did have you on, I think, about 3 years ago, because we were talking about Veltman, weren't we? Because we'd signed Joel Veltman, and you were saying about how you were a bit sceptical about the whole notion of him being signed as a right back, because you'd seen him playing mainly as a centre back. And it's been interesting that I kind of almost forgotten that, because he's been playing predominantly as a right back for us when he's played, and he's settled in well. I think he's done certainly as well as any of us could have hoped, and turned out to be a really good bargain.
I think he's probably one of the best value signings we've ever made, isn't he? £900,000, and
he
rarely goes below 7 out of 10. Veltman, he's been brilliant for us.
And we were just saying in the end of the last part that he's just emerged in the most fouled top five most fouled players in the Premier League, which I did not see coming, I have to say. But what have you made of him, first of all, now that he's been in the Prem for a while? Thoughts on that?
So firstly, I'd say when he was with the Dutch national team a lot and with Ajax, winning some leagues in what was a poor area of his year at the time. The league's moved on a lot, I think, since then. He didn't stand out a lot, because he would have defensive errors in the games, and he was getting to sort of mid-20s, you know, like he wanted to kick on and really like prove what a young talent he was and the potential he had to go on and make that big move. He didn't show that when he was with Ajax, but I always felt like when he was at centre-back, he'd be able to be really good on the ball, but was never physically big enough. So then playing at right-back, after he had a couple of big injuries in his career, coming in at right-back, seemed to suit him a little better, but still the same errors were there. And I'm all I can say is well done to the guy. And he's gone on and flourished with Brighton. It's really suited him. Not being at the top of the Premier League, he's been able to build up with Brighton bit by bit through his years. And he's definitely suited to a full-back role, isn't he? Right back, I think. I think he's had a good career since then. And well done to him.
Yeah, we've had a bit of a tradition with Dutch players playing for us. I mean, way back when we had Hans Kraaij, that's going back a fair few years. Michel Kuipers, who was a goalkeeper and stalwart for us for quite a while in the sort of middle divisions for a while. And more recently, and probably not so notably, Danny Holler, although there's a brilliant song we have for him. I can't remember the words. It was quite amusing about getting up to stuff in Amsterdam. And Roland Bergkamp, who I think was Dennis's nephew, not the most illustrious Dutch players, but certainly Joel Veltman has transformed things back in the right direction on that in that form. And it's the three Vs, because we've now got Van Hecker, who we signed as a young player and we've brought on, loaned out, and has now made his way into the first team. And of course, most recently, we signed in the summer Bart Verbruggen, who is being rated as one of the best young goalkeepers around. So tell us about what your impressions are of them, both in terms of what you already knew and what you've thought since they've got into the Albion first team.
Sure. So when they were all signed, I was most enthusiastic about Verbruggen and I was least enthusiastic about Van Hecker at the time, because I thought when Brighton were developing, there wouldn't be that place for him. And then I saw how brilliant he got on against Haaland last season. And I was like, oh, wow, OK, he has arrived. And he's kicked on a lot. And I think that move to the Championship helped him after being with Heerenveen. That's done him a lot of good, because he's then been able to add that physical side to his game. I was fortunate enough to interview them for football down here, and the three of them together. And they're such great company. Like, they are three completely different characters. You've got Veltman, who's like that wise ahead, isn't he? He's always got the right perspective, the right thing to say, I feel like, who brings that sort of side to it. Then you've got Verbruggen, who's really eloquent. His English is amazing. Like, you think he went to private school or something, or like an English school. And he's really intelligent. And I can see that people might not realize just how young he is, and how young he is for a goalkeeper in particular. Like, he will go on and have a very, very good career. He's like the Netherlands number one as well at the moment, with a bit of inconsistency, albeit there with who is the first choice. But he's actually really liked by Dutch football fans, and people think that he is the answer now. Justin Bijlo's a final goalkeeper. He's who he's up against, and Bijlo's a really good goalkeeper. And finally, you've got Van Hecker, who just seems like an absolute barrel of laughs, doesn't he? He's an absolute prankster. I really, really like him, and a completely different character against the other two. But together, they seem to all really get on. And I think that sums up the Brighton dressing room at the minute. You've got a lot of different people from all around the world, and they really get on as a team, don't they? But no more so, I think, than those three, who are going to absolutely love playing in Amsterdam.
Yeah. And of course, we've got this huge game coming up. And guys, feel free to chip in with any questions. In terms of the Ajax game, obviously, we've got the win in the last match, a vital win for us, our first ever win in Europe, which is great. And now we've got to step on. We want to try and do the double over Ajax purely to get those extra points on the board, which will more or less guarantee us, I think, at least some kind of continuation of involvement in Europe this season. It's going to be interesting to see. There's been a couple of twists since we last played them. Obviously, you've got the interim managers come in. They have finally got those first wins, haven't they, back-to-back, I think. And as I understand it, they had a game abandoned very late in the match when they were 3-2 up, which is yet to be completed, I think I'm right to say, in which, obviously, it looks like they're going to win that game as well. So it's looking like they're moving, drifting casually into mid-table now. I must admit, I didn't think they looked great when we played them. I felt we were in second gear in the game, to be honest, and that boded well for this other fixture. But do we need to get more nervous here, Michael? Are they significantly improving since we last played them a couple of weeks ago?
Yes and yes. I think this could be a really good game. I was just doing my own podcast, my own show, previewing the game, and I went for, I mean, you might want to talk about the predictions later, a bit more detail, but I thought a 2-2, but I do think Brighton do have that quality. They do have the goals. I think they should win in Amsterdam, but I do think this is going to be a lot more of an exciting game. Why? Because they do have tons of quality. I do think with the wins are going to pick up now, Ajax will climb up to probably fifth place in the league come the end of the season. Now we're a third away through the campaign. The league's really settling into a pattern. They're not going to catch up with that top four. But they are going to pick up lots of wins now, between now and Christmas, against teams that are in this mid-table positions. Feyenoord beat them in Amsterdam. PSV beat them heavily. AZ are beating them in Amsterdam 2-1. They've played away at Utrecht 4-3. That was an extraordinary game. So it's like they've got all the tough fixtures out of the way, and now they're playing some teams low down the league. So they will push up. But their two wins against Volendam and Heerenveen, for me, back-to-back in Amsterdam, within 3 days, that has really turned their confidence. John Van Schip has, of course, come in, as you said, as the new manager. And I think he's got the team a bit close together. There's a lot more stability, predictability in the way they're playing. It's a lot more of Ajax, but they're also not afraid to use a long ball, I'm noticing. using the wide areas. Brian Brumby's that big striker up front. And I just think this has a different complexion about it entirely now. I was fully expecting Brighton to wipe the floor with Ajax. Like you said, second gear. So it was a 2-0 win. Brighton didn't really care how they got the 3 points really that evening. They just wanted to get that first win in Europe, didn't they?
Yeah.
Now this is a much more exciting game. So I think Brighton will also go up in their gears. But it will make for a really good game.
Yeah. Well, I know Alan and Peter both wanted to come in on that. I don't know if, Alan, your point was going to be to do what's just been said, or whether Peter, who wants to go first?
Yeah, I think you did cover some of what I was going to ask and say myself, but I saw the headline of the 4-1 win that they had just recently. I mean, have they changed? Has the manager changed personnel? Is it just a case of just getting the players a little bit more motivated and making a few tweaks to the situation?
That's a great question. Yeah, there definitely have been some personnel changes. A couple forced, such as the goalkeeper, Ramayat, had to come in. Some have stayed the same. I mean, Sotalo and Harto, the two centre-backs, have played lots of this season, but still need that consistency to play together some more. So there is that kind of relationship trying to be built there. The most interesting ones have been, first of all, at left-back, they've decided to play their young winger, who's never really played for the first team before, left winger at left back. And it's made for some interesting results. He's playing so high up the pitch, not really defensive at all. And him linking up with Steven Bergwijn down the left has been magical. So it's already, Van der Skip has done something tactically that's worked. And would he have the bravery to play Marta against Brighton? I think he will. And I think you'll see a bit of a, it'll line up as a 4-3-3, but I think that back three will be Harto, Sotalo and Guy moving across, and Marta will push really hard at the pitch. It's going to make an interesting dynamic with Brighton's wingers. How are they going to match up to that? Like, are they going to be forcing them back, or will they not be able to get us forward? And maybe we're going to get a bit exposed down those wide areas. And in terms of other changes, Steven Berghaus has come back. He seems to be fully fit now. And Christian Hlynsson is an Icelandic attacking midfielder, again from the academy, and looks really, really good. He looks really damn good. Yeah.
Guy, I think it's Guy, he was playing right back, is that right, in the last game?
Yes.
He impressed me, actually. I thought he had a pretty solid game. He did all he could, really. You know, they're overawed a bit, but I think he did quite well there. He looks a good prospect as well. But yeah, you're right. The other guy, the striker, looks, he looks a real tasty number, and we'll have to watch out for him. I think it sounds like he might start this game as well.
I think it's going to be unchanged. They've had two games where they've had the same 11, and he just, I think that the phrase is never change a winning team. And even the Dutch say that. In the Netherlands, they say it in English, and they sound very Dutch when they say it. But the motto rings true for what they're trying to do at the minute. Just win games. They have not won games this season at all. They've won once in the league until the last two wins just now. So this is a change. I don't think they'll be exhausted. They've had from Sunday off, that will be fine. But I think in time, yes, they will have to make some change. At the minute, just bedding in this starting 11 with young players there, people in just because of injury, but also quality players like Sotalo, who's meant to be a brilliant centre back, hasn't been so far this season, just finding form and confidence. So yeah, that's why I think there'll be no change. It's quite a predictable lineup. I could be surprised. But again, I think Branko van der Bomen plays midfield next to Kenneth Taylor. I think that will stay the same. People will come off the bench. Chuba Akpom probably will come off the bench. Scored some goals off the bench in the last couple of games. So I think he'll come off the bench again. And I think he's going to have an impact as well.
Ooh. We had him on loan briefly at one point.
You did.
Could come back to haunt us. Peter, yeah, you wanted to come in as well.
Yeah, I was just going to ask what's happened to Ajax, I suppose. I mean, from the outside, obviously, they're the biggest club in the group by a distance, probably. You know, even, I mean, like Marseille have won the European Cup, but Ajax are huge. And I looked at that team 2 weeks ago and they just didn't seem interested.
No.
And they didn't seem to know what tactics they were playing. Once they couldn't sit deep, but even at 2-0, they weren't pressing. They weren't trying to win the ball back to try and get a goal. 10 minutes left, you think, well, if you get a goal at this point, 2-1, it's a tricky finish. You know, Brighton are holding on. It's a big game for us. Maybe we make a mistake. But they didn't seem to press. The way we played second half, it was like a training exercise. We didn't even get pressed on the ball at all. We just passed it round and they just didn't look interested. And it's like, you wonder what happened to them, and how it is that he's turned it round so quickly that they've won too.
Yeah, the thing that surprises me the most is how quickly that's turned around. And this Brighton game is a good test just about how far they've come, how it's gone from one thing to another. Like, it all started, I think, when their backroom team started to fall apart. So Mark Overmars had to leave. Inappropriate behaviour was what was stated by the club. Emi van der Sar left in the summer as well. Obviously, he's had poor health himself. Then Erik ten Hag went to Manchester United, but Ajax seemed to have the right idea in the backroom team to keep it alive, to keep the money coming into the club with selling their younger players and spending it on players like Tusen Tadic, Sebastian Haller, who were from the Premier League, that are really good players and can shine in a team like Ajax. You can get the best out of them. So they were able to do that for a number of years. And then it just fell apart completely because players just left. And this happened two summers in a row. And that's highly damaging, of course. So with two halves of teams just eradicated over the past two summers, you're not left with very much. Players haven't really settled from those couple of seasons before. I think there's been poor scouting. They had a new director of football come in about April this year, and he got the sack because of some really odd behaviour before the final game, which they lost 4-0, just unsettling the team. He basically assembled a bunch of players that were really good players on paper, but I don't know how he thought they'd play together. Like, you signed Huber Atpom expecting that he would be the first choice striker for Ajax, I guess. But then why? Because they've already got a striker there, Brobby, who is the first choice and spent a lot of money on. And then another Georgian young striker you might be aware of who's doing really good for Georgia national team and just isn't getting any game. So why have they signed two strikers? So they have three that all should really be start. Just there's no thought about it. So the scouting was good, but knowing no real idea about what the final outcome would look like. They've had some flops as well over the years. Yeah, one thing led to another. And then this season, Maurice Stijn, the manager, not good. And yeah, confidence is a massive thing in football, isn't it? So even the team that finished third in the league last season, they've fallen apart again. And it just became that they ended up at the bottom of the table at one point. But now, new manager, I think confidence come back. Their quality is there. They're the most expensively assembled team in the whole of the league. So they're going to have a bit of a comeback. I just don't think it's going to be quite still what people expect from Ajax at the start of the season or the season before. This Ajax team has gone a long way backwards.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, sorry, Alan. Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, I was curious about a couple of outgoings from last season or a couple of seasons. You've obviously, I was interested to know what the opinion of the Ajax fans of how Ten Hag's doing at Manchester United.
Yeah.
And also, there was a lot of rumours going around that we were interested in Kudos.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how true that was. You know, there's lots of those kind of rumours going around. He obviously went to West Ham and he's doing quite well there. I think he's become a little bit of a cult hero at West Ham. I'm just interested to know what the views there were for the Ajax fans.
Well, Ten Hag, first of all, I think they'd take him back in a heartbeat. That's for sure. Given my own perspective on it as a Dutch football fan, I've done a couple of Manchester United shows recently where I've talked about Ten Hag, and I think he's lost a bit of the authority that he gained when he first came in, because he's quite a big, strict character. Ajax players have even talked about that before. And then going into United, he's won the respect of the dressing room. But with how this season's gone, he's sort of losing that because his tactics aren't working, are they? Is it the players? Is it his tactics? Maybe the players feel like it's that they're not able to be professional enough to be at 100% to overlook that, put in that extra effort. So then the effort starts to go. And then it's a bit of a vicious cycle, I think, for United. So where do they go from here? I think Ten Hag is going to stay and sort it out, but I just don't think he's going to get that style of play that he's big about and was famous for with the creating space. That's just, it seems like a bit of a back burner idea at the moment. But he was so good at that with Ajax, and I do think he's a very good coach. I think if the Netherlands job ever comes at one day, I think Ten Hag is a prime candidate for that if he struggles with United so much that he gets a sack. So not much respect will be lost for him in the Netherlands. As for Kudus, from what I understand, it was true with Brighton, and Kudus himself turned the club down. The reasons why, now this part I'm not so clear on, but I'm led to believe it's because I know he's on a Brighton podcast, I don't think he liked the size of the club. I think he's one of those players that wants to go right to the top, He ended up at West Ham. The only thing I could think that appealed to him was bigger fan base, bigger stadium. I don't know, but it doesn't seem like the right move when you consider his reasons there for Brighton. They're in the same competition in the Europa League. Brighton are on the way up. They're higher up the table than West Ham. They're a more attractive proposition to join now. Maybe West Ham just offer more money. The exact reasons I cannot comment on too much, but I do know that he was quite vocal about Brighton. And bits did come out in the media, sort of little quotes about what his opinion was. And to be honest, it sounds like a bit of a dodge bullet for you guys if you're going to have a player like that. You don't really want someone who has opinions like that.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We don't want someone who's basically judged the club by what fan base and history and that sort of thing, rather than how they could fit in now. Yeah.
Exactly. And on the matter of Ten Hag, yeah, I mean, I think, ironically, he's in a situation at Man United which is probably not dissimilar to what's happening now at Ajax in terms of lack of focus and difficulties behind the scenes. It's always difficult for, I think, a coach or manager to flourish in those circumstances. So, yeah, I mean, maybe it's not the right time for him. I rate him. I think he's a great coach. But for some reason, it doesn't seem to be clicking. Part of that is just the disruption behind the scenes. And again, recruitment focus is a bit weird and wayward, isn't it? I'm not impressed with some of Man U's signings, to be honest. But yeah, who knows? It's a strange one. I was going to say my final question on Ajax is, in terms of the other Dutch fans, I mean, I'm presuming they're all loving this, aren't they? What's been happening so far this season?
Definitely. Yeah, they're an absolute laughing stock in the Netherlands. People on the outside look in and go, oh, poor Ajax, historical club, loved it when they were doing so well. And in the Netherlands, I can tell you, it's totally opposite. It is like a clown show, circus. It would be like, you can imagine what Manchester United would be like if they were bottom of the table. People would just be ripping out of the jokes out of them all of the time. And that's what happens to having the Ajax. Anything that gets posted on social media, people are making jokes, people laugh at reactions to everything. Yeah, you can imagine.
Memes galore.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, that's mad, isn't it? It's a mad situation, but it's going to be interesting. I mean, we're really proud of the fact we've got a result against this club. I know the circumstances are a certain way at the moment, but when we look back on this, it'll be, oh yeah, our first game against Ajax 2-0. Love that. We're hoping we can do the double. That'll be even better. It's, as you've alluded to, it's going to be a bit tougher than we might have thought, to say it full time on the week before last. In terms of what we can expect, obviously it's going to be a tougher game. It's going to be an entertaining game. In terms of the actual visit, I'm presuming you've been over there to that venue, and you know what it's like on a match day. What can we expect as fans?
So I won't be going there this week, but I have been to Ajax before, been to the stadium. So I would say Ajax are up there with the best fans of the Netherlands. I think there are one or two more raucous stadiums there. I think there's a bit more of a family feel in parts of a stadium, if you know what I'm saying. However, yeah, there is a very vocal, very vociferous part of the stadium. If you look, I mean, you'll see it on the TV sometimes, but sort of the right side that's behind one of the goals. If let's say we'll come on the same side the players were, where the press box and manager sit, it's on the right side. That's where all the home fans are. And yeah, you have your smoke, you have your atmosphere, probably your banners, and we'll sing very loudly, especially after the half-time music, if you aren't aware what the half-time tune is.
Three
Little Birds. They love that. They're great support. I know that every fan base has got their ultras in Europe, you could say. In the Netherlands, it's no different. Ajax fans, they're well known. I think Brighton fans will be safe. I mean, of course, RZ fans didn't make West Ham or Legia Warsaw feel very safe. But I know Ajax probably won't be quite like that. I think fans have a really good time. If they're going to Amsterdam, enjoy it.
Yeah, we've all been before, but it's not to the ground, obviously. So yeah. Really looking forward to it. It's going to be a good, a great trip. Michael, before we round off, one thing we probably asked it when you came on before, but just to, out of interest, why Dutch football? What got you particularly into that particular country's football originally?
So I'm also an Aston Villa fan. And when Wilfred Bauma, who was our left back at the time, he was my favourite player, bit of a childhood thing. But then he went back to the Netherlands after having his bad injuries. Played for PSV, I was really interested, so I watched a little bit and then just really enjoyed the league, full of goals. It's just fun watching like young players come through that are like 19, 20, whatever, make a name for themselves and just coming out of nowhere and developing within one season to be an incredible player. And then just seeing if they'll sink or swim, going to another country. Are they the real deal or are they not? I think there's so many little subplots within the Netherlands you can enjoy. There's the growing of the league itself. It's gone from being like the 15th best league in Europe up to being the 6th best league in Europe now. So it's a growing league. I think people need to get a bit more time sometimes in the UK. You can watch it on Mola, which is an app you can get on your phone. It's on the computer as well. If you sign up for free, you get to watch 4 games a week live. You can watch the highlights, which is great. So I think there's a lot to love about the league. Always entertaining. There can be some dodgy defending sometimes, but that makes it great fun. I just got into it. And one thing that's another now, 10 years later, I've been doing this kind of stuff for 10 years. So yeah, love it.
Brilliant. And you're UK based, presumably, are you? And just go over to games when you can? Is that it?
Yeah, I go to games when I can. I went to the RZ against Villa match. Really love that. Do bits and pieces when we can.
Okay. Love it. And just to finish off, plug your show. So you mentioned it before. What's it called and how can people find it?
Brilliant, thanks. So Football Aranya is the name of our show or website. We do like all the match reports of all the Eredivisie games. We follow the Netherlands national team extensively as well on what we do. So it's sort of two sides, what we do, the league and then the national team. We do podcasts and interviews with players. Like I said, the 3 Brighton players are there. That's on our YouTube channel. So that sort of sits there. But like I said, most of what we do is for the website, on our Twitter, X. And you can spell it. So it's football in English and then orange, but replace a G with a J, Football Aranya. Yep, we're on all different social media platforms, but those are the main places. And on Twitter, I'm at Eredivisie Mike, which was a bit of a brave move calling myself the league in there. But it seems so worked out. So
you're not to pick yourself up at all, no.
No. But I do watch too much of the league and I'm a bit of a nerd on it all. So
fantastic. That's great to hear. Well, thanks very much for joining us again. It's good to get you back on and hopefully we'll have some more exciting discussions to have. Maybe if we progress through and play one of the other Dutch teams or, you know, other Dutch signings coming up, we shall certainly get back in touch with you. But it's been great to have you on. So thanks for joining us, Michael.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Yeah, so thanks very much there to Michael Statham for joining us to talk about the big game coming up midweek when the Albion go to the Amsterdam Arena, would you believe? I can't wait for it. Anyway, third and final part, and it's a very brief one. We're just going to quickly summarise the rest of the football from the weekend, namely the FA Cup. And we've got to start with one of the most preposterous football scores of all time. The game finished Swindon Town 4, Aldershot Town 7, Swindon of League 2, Aldershot of the National League, Prem, who are up mid-table, I think, and actually doing quite well now this season. They have Lauren Tolai in their team, a former Albion youth player who used to score goals for fun, had an injury, don't know what happened after that, but he ended up getting released. And he scored the 4th and 6th goals as they bounded their way to a 7-0 lead, 4-0 at half-time, 7-0 during the second half. Great goals from Tolai, by the way. He drilled one in with his left foot and then cracked in an absolute beauty of a volley with his right foot into the top corner. So fantastic there. Alan, you wanted to come in straight away on this.
I was just going to butt in and say that I actually live quite close to Aldershot. I must go down there and take a look. I've been there a few times, but I need to get down there again.
That's actually one of the grounds I've not ticked off yet, so I do need to get down there, actually.
I'll take you down there where you can go.
Marvellous. A night out or a day out in Aldershot. What could be better? Right? But what a game that was. I mean, that was a record. It's the highest number of goals scored by a non-league team against a league team in FA Cup history. So that's quite an extraordinary start to the weekend summary. We've got Peter, yeah.
I was going to say, shout out to the 3 eighth-tier teams. Bracknell went close against Cambridge, only lost 2-1, which was, to be fair, pretty good. Ramsgate beat Woking 2-1 and are in the third round, the second round.
Well.
And Cray Valley Paper Mill got a fantastic draw at Charlton, which was an incredible result and thoroughly deserved. They were really good second half, I thought.
You were there, weren't you?
I didn't in the end, no.
Because
he wasn't very well, so I couldn't make it in the end. But I watched the second half on TV and... But just to say, their FA Cup run started on the 19th of August away at Lordswood, where they drew 1-1 before beating them in a replay. They've since also beaten Uxbridge, Northwood.
That was a replay again then.
Northwood. Yeah, in a replay again. Then the third round, they beat Carshalton also in a replay. Then they beat Enfield, and now they've drawn at Charlton. And this weekend, they were supposed to be playing at home to Balham if they hadn't played at Charlton. So what an achievement for them. And the and the assist for the goal came from, of all the people, Kevin Lisby's son, which was a nice link to Charlton, which I hadn't realised is that he played for Cray Valley as well, Kevin Lisby himself for a while. Yeah. It was a proper old school Charlton reunion because Carl Leeburn's son was playing for Charlton as well. So it's a proper old-fashioned Charlton strikers, like sons reunion.
Lisby's son, I think his name's Correll, actually made his debut as a 16-year-old, coming off the bench, replacing his dad to make his debut as well at Cray Valley. Yeah, so incredible story.
Yeah, well done to them, though. That's a hell of an achievement. Five divisions apart. That is, you know, phenomenal.
One all draw, and they've got the replay. So they've got, what, the 10th game of their campaign already?
Yeah, and I think they've got, like, 14, 15 games between now and, like, New Year's Day, which, I mean, we complained about fixture congestion, but...
Yeah, they've only played five league games, I think, because of the Cup run.
Well, I think all three of them at that level have pretty much five or six. Yeah. Ramsgate and Bracknell as well. Yeah. I mean, it's...
Is it right they've drawn Gillingham, or rather Charlton?
Away,
at Priestley. If you like, a North Kent stroke, South East London derby.
Yeah, it's quite a local one again, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes, I mean, to be honest, if there were rewards Gillingham away, do you really want it?
Also, just to say, Cray Valley Paper Mills took 2,000 fans to the Valley as well.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, there's loads of people that go for a one-off, but nonetheless, that's a superb following as well. I like
150 is their average crowd, so...
Yeah. Green and black they play in. I like those colours.
Yeah. I thought they deserved it as well. They played really well second half, especially, and looked actually for a while on top. Start of second half.
Their team did look good on paper.
That was a run of the mill joke there, Alan, wasn't it?
<I'm sorry.
laughs> Oh no, that's just terrible. I wish we could just rub that out, but it wasn't written in pencil. Elsewhere, well, there was also, I mean, there was another giant killing, which it doesn't feel like it because they're a swaggersome team that are steaming their way back towards the league. But Chesterfield got a 1-0 win at home to Portsmouth. Both teams top of their respective divisions, Chesterfield National League, Prem, Portsmouth, the highest ranking team in the tournament as it stands at top of League One. A 1-0 win, I'm delighted with that. Always good to see Portsmouth knocked out of the FA Cup. Chesterfield through to, obviously, to the next round. Peter, sorry, yep.
I was going to say, also, Grimsby, fresh from getting to the quarterfinals last year, were actually 15 minutes away from losing at Slough, with a brilliant goal from Slough's player-manager,
Jackson
Davies. Yeah. So he was Scott Davies, who's their player-manager, scored a really good free kick, won the goals of the round to put Slough ahead, and they held on until 15 minutes from time to get close. I mean, Grimsby got to the quarterfinals last year, but we're close to getting knocked out, and probably will win the replay now, but
Slough's got a nice ground. I've been there this season to see a Worthing game and ended up on that COCOMS scenario. But actually, I don't know what it is, but on Match of the Day, I think it was I've forgotten his name, the presenter, but on Match of the Day's FA Cup highlights, they alluded to a really interesting backstory. He'd had a lot of problems, the manager as well. I don't know, some sort of personal issues. And I think he actually gave up the game, but then came back into it. And then he was quite happy to stay at that level. He doesn't want to play above that level. So he's quite enjoying playing what is basically National League South. And I was impressed with them when they played Worthing. Worthing actually won it 4-1. But I thought Slough were a decent side, a bit unlucky to lose so heavily that day. And I think they're in lower mid-table. It's good, whatever that backstory is, to come back from whatever troubles and hardships he might have had, the manager. It's a great story for him to be the man to get what unfortunately should have been a winning goal, but at least it was a significant goal in matters. Speaking of Worthing, unfortunately, their runs come to the end. First time in 25 years at this level, but they lost a game against, equal opposition, and I think it was quite an even game. 2-0 defeat in the end to Alfreton Town. Horsham, on the other hand, though, another Sussex side, absolutely brilliant. They went 1-0 down, 2-1 up, 3-2 down, and then got a late equaliser, a bit of a cracker as well, to get a 3-3 draw, didn't they, Peter? I've gone blank. Who were they playing?
Barnsley,
that was it. What a result. Barnsley, a
decent... Yeah, and it was really annoyingly moved to Friday night by South Yorkshire Police for some unknown reason that they just didn't really fancy working Saturday or something. So, fewer Horsham fans could go than would have hoped to go. But yeah, great results, and to take them back. And Barnsley won't fancy that. It's a bit of a trek down in November, you know. They probably won't fancy kind of a Tuesday night in Horsham, whatever. So hopefully, although to be fair, Horsham's ground is actually a bit nice, probably. They probably want a crappy old ground, really, don't they? But from memory, their pitch was quite nice, and the ground was all quite nice and modern. They probably want it to be really dishevelled and run down and kind of...
What's the name of that beer we like again, Peter?
Spanky McDanky.
Spanky McDanky, that's it. That was a
good one. I don't think the Barnsley players will be drinking that.
Any other great stories from the FA Cup briefly?
Nothing huge, I don't think, other than that, that we've missed. A few kind of teams winning from division above sort of thing, but nothing massive. Yeah. But yeah, I don't think there's an all non-league game in the next round. So, but hopefully we've got one or two giant killings to bring a non-league side into the third round proper. And we'll be, in 3 weeks' time, is it? We'll know who we've got 3 weeks, 4 weeks' time.
Ramsgate away, maybe. Quite fancy.
Who did Ramsgate get? I can't remember.
I can't remember either, to be honest. I think they got an away game. Most of them did get away games. I think 2/3 of them did, but anyway. But no, fantastic.
Are they Wimbledon, possibly?
Oh, yeah, it might be Wimbledon, yeah. Alan?
Yeah, we could be beaten up to a pulp by Ray Valley.
Stop it now.
It is. God.
He's on paper-thin ground, isn't he, with these puns? They're just dreadful. Oh dear, the whole podcast has come to a halt. You could say it's gone stationary. But anyway, let's stop there before we go any further. This is really painful now. So no, that was a good weekend of FA Cup action. Disappointing result for the Albion. Disappointing result, but also a good result for the Albion women. We move on. We're on to the next week. We've got Ajax, of course. That will be our next one, a special midweek special from Amsterdam. And then, of course, we've got Sheffield United at the weekend, for which we'll probably do a review pod sometime afterwards. So thank you for joining us. Thank you to Michael Statham for joining us earlier on as well. And we'll conclude in the usual way, Peter, by saying stand or fall.
Up the Albion.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.